This is the Let's Grab Coffee podcast, and I'm your host, George Khalife.
Vic, appreciate you finally being on the podcast, even though I've known you for quite some time now.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We have to settle something, even though, again, I feel like we're friends now and good friends in the ecosystem. Walk me through the last name pronunciation in the Italian sense. You know, I want to get to this before we get going.
The Italian sense is Pascucci.
Pascucci.
There you go. That's it.
That's good. What I wanted to say with like that dramatic flair in the background, you know, Vic Pascucci.
Awesome. There you go. Love it.
Thanks for being here, man. For a lot of folks in Chicago will know you. My audience though is global, half in North America, half in the Middle East. For folks who don't, you have a very interesting story because you know, you're a guy who comes from traditionally the legal background. Right. So you got your JD, you worked for a law firm. You then pivoted into general counsel for a software company, and somehow, some way, you know, kind of the grittiness inside you gets you into the VC space. Right. So now you're a very well-known venture capital investor in Chicago. You've been a VC in the sort of tech space. Now you're in the energy capital space, particularly in ESG and hydrogen, which we'll get into. Mm-hmm. What I really wanted to get going with you is how does someone start on the legal side and then pivot into VC?
Yeah, you know, I think the real lesson is in that if you, no matter what you want to do, especially if it's getting into VC, you can get into VC. It really doesn't matter what your background is, where you come from, what you do. The issue is it's never going to be this direct linear A to B, and it's probably going to take a whole lot longer than you want it to take. Because for me, it did at least, right? So a lot of people do make that legal to finance transition, but I started out as a trial attorney. So the furthest afield of true transactional work. And I noticed when I was a lawyer going to court with her every day, fighting with people, I started getting attuned to this technology industry where no one was angry and fighting, but they were happy and building. I was like, well, that sounds a lot better than doing what I'm doing. And the only way I knew to kind of get into that industry itself was to become a lawyer for technology companies and investors in those companies. And since no one was going to hire a trial attorney, no law firm was going to hire a trial attorney to go do technology work, because if you're making money for a firm one way, they kind of want to keep you there. I decided to start my own law firm representing technology companies and investors, and just kind of self-taught my way from there. And then, you know, from there, one of the guys that I was working all too hard and all too long to get his business from my law firm finally said, no, I won't hire your firm, but I will make you my first general counsel. So that got me really into the belly of the beast of startups, you know, raising money, managing cap tables, a lot of raising money, pitching investors, and really got excited about the ability to work on the investment side mm-hmm. and work not just with one company, but many companies, and just be around these brilliant people and help them achieve their dreams. And I had no idea how I was going to get into venture. I had no idea how I was going to go from that side to the other, but I always knew I wanted to. And so through one crazy M&A deal after another, I ended up actually in San Antonio, Texas, working for a Fortune 100 company as the lawyer for their CIO, CTO, CISO, and head of business operations. And would see these, I was in financial services where I did most of my early investing in fintech and financial services. And I would see these large companies relying on these technology companies and startups for these big strategic initiatives. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I was like, well, we need to invest in these companies, right? They're relying on us. We're relying on them. There's no better way to align and capture upside than putting capital at risk with these companies. We need to do that. And at that time, our company was with, they're like, shut up, we don't do that here. Quit talking like that. You're going to get fired. Stop it. But I was like, well, I'm the startup guy in this big company. I'm going to get fired eventually. So we might as well like make a difference along the way and have some fun. And eventually just aggravated them into literally doing venture capital and corporate, what was then corporate venture capital. So started doing a deal here, a deal there, you know, built that up to $330 million fund. Bunch of wow. IPOs came out of it. A bunch of billion-dollar companies came out of that. They're still holding their valuations. And from there, realized I wanted to kind of go from the corporate venture world to a more traditional role. And that's what got me on what I'm on now. Now, understanding that was about a 15-year time period, right?
This is not so 2 months. Yeah,
it's not linear sequential. It didn't happen as quickly as anybody wanted. And you just got to keep grinding and grinding and grinding, and that word probably gets overused now, you just have to keep moving forward, be disciplined, do the best you can with the opportunities that are right there in front of you, understanding there's something else out there, but you've got to make the best of what you got right in front of you there.
Yeah, a close mentor of mine actually, who's now our CEO, of TMX Group, said the same thing. He's like, and I remember I was still kind of a young associate, and he drilled that into me because it resonated a lot. He's like, most people are always worried about the next step, the next level, the next promotion. But he's like, you lose sight of what you're supposed to be executing on now, and let alone what you're executing on now is what's going to open doors. Maybe not at the current company. Maybe it's a completely different vertical, different industry. But if you don't do what you're doing now, then people around you are going to look and say, well, that person, as great as Vic is, as great as Jordan is, well, not executing on their current mandate.
Exactly.
So what conviction do I have that they can do that in the next role?
Yeah, you're never going to get ahead being ungrateful for the opportunities you have now, and you're never going to get ahead doing anything other than executing at the highest levels as to what you've got right here and now.
How do you know, though, one challenge I've had in my career is knowing when to keep pushing, knowing when to kind of pivot. When did you know, like, when were those pivotal moments in your career, whether you go from legal to general counsel to your first VC gig? When was that point where you're like, you know what, now is the time. Now I'm ready. I've been kind of heads down, pounding the pavement.
Yeah. You know, some of them were, it was just an opportunity where it felt right. And some of them, it was a little bit of a forced realization, right? And, you know, when I went from, in the legal field, from trial work to transactional work, you know, my law firm I was working for, they were just upfront with me. They're like, we make too much money with you doing what you're doing now. I'm going to support you doing this. So it's like, I was still in my 20s. I was like, okay, I guess I have to go do this on my own, right? When I was agitating or initiating, you know, doing venture capital investments in a large Fortune 100 company, I just knew it was the right thing to do. Like, I knew it was the right thing to do for the company I was working with, even if they didn't realize it, and for the startups. And I knew it was going to make everyone's life better and our customers' lives better for the company I was working with. And it's kind of hard because, you know, especially in larger companies, and it's the same for smaller companies, you push too hard and you alienate people, right? You push in the right fashion so people understand you're doing it for a bigger purpose. You're doing it for the right reasons. You're not doing it for yourself. Like, I truly believe, and to this day in my heart of hearts, the deals I did back then were the best things for that company and their customers or members, right? And so, kind of going from that perspective, it's okay to push. And then sometimes, though, you just got to be at the point going, it's not going to get any better, right? This is it. I need to make that big jump and that big leap. Like, even when I was doing corporate venture, I knew I was only going to go so far as a venture capitalist in the corporate paradigm, right? I knew there was only so much of an impact I was going to be able to have in that role. So it just came to a point where I was like, it's time. I need to leave now before I start to get too comfortable or my performance starts to not develop and you got to call it.
And for someone who, you know, kind of moved into the venture space for the first time, it's not like, you know, you grew through the ranks naturally in your career in venture. And I think that's one of the most inspiring pieces, at least for me in your story, is that you make it visible to other people that, hey, you can crack into this vertical that to a lot of people seems like a sheltered industry. You know, you're either growing through the ranks as an early analyst associate, or you have money, or it's kind of very difficult to get into it, right? It's a bit of a club in that sense.
Sure.
What was the steepest learning curve for you getting into venture?
I think for me, the steepest curve was really understanding some of those kind of cultural norms that enable you to be the most effective at the role, right? So, you know,
what are examples of those?
Like, if you come from a legal background, let alone a litigator trial background, it's always win-win-win as forcefully as you can, as quick as you can, and just like win every point. Like, it doesn't matter, just keep winning. When you're in venture, understanding like you're going to be married to these people, whether you're co-investors or you're entrepreneurs or anyone else, for at least 10 years minimum, right? If you're investing at the early stage. So it's really about developing the relationship, not scoring points, right? It's about where you think you could be in 5 and 10 years with this group, not in the next 5 minutes over a negotiation point that really doesn't matter, right? Or trying to prove that you're right about things. Because at the end of the day, you're foolish in this business to believe you're going to be right because no one knows the actual answers, right? You have your experience, you have your decision models, you weigh certain factors, and you just provide that to people and let them make their own decisions, right? It's not about like forcing winning. And it took me time to sit in those boardrooms with some of like the best and brightest venture capitalists I've ever met, even to this day, seeing how they operate, seeing when they know when to push versus pull, seeing where they need to like sit up a little higher versus sit back a little. And that's something I'm still learning today, let's be clear, but to really see how people get are effective in those norms of the different boardrooms and in sourcing deals and working through relationships. That was something that, you know, to this day, I got to keep working on.
Yeah, some of those nuances, I guess. Yeah. But you really only can also develop over time because it's not something you can just read in an article or talk.
Yeah, the technical stuff you can read, right? You can read Bradfeld, you can read venture deals 1,000 times and understand like term sheets and all the things. And that's part of it. Like, you got to do that work. You got to come up with that baseline understanding, right? But I think also then coming in from the outside of this business, what you learn is like the hype and hyperbole that's in a lot of these articles versus the reality of what happens and what's really going on. And, you know, so then you kind of learn that over time. And then I also think kind of one of the larger learnings of it was just understanding when you come from the outside coming in, you think this whole business is about doing deals, like finding entrepreneurs, giving them money. That's part of it, right? But the real job is to raise money from other people so you have the money to invest. It's kind of table stakes that you're going to do good deals and work with great entrepreneurs. But then the other hard part is actually getting money back to the people that gave it to you, right? So the work only just starts when you do the deal, right? On that element, understanding that the work even to get up to that point, the years and years of developing your skill set and your reputation and your track record so that you can raise money from people in the first place, that's what's really hard. And so really coming from the outside looking in, like I always thought the business was just doing the deal. And then like, you know, the returns happen. Yes, you coach, you mentor, whatever, but then they're not understanding that the real business is raising the capital and the real, real business is returning the capital, right?
Right. And all the managing in between, because to even return the capital, you have to be supportive to these portcos. And there's so much in there that I guess people don't realize. Again, it's kind of like the Suits fallacy or the Grey's Anatomy. You know, yeah. You see the glamour, the glitz and appeal of something. Right.
It's kind of like everyone wanted to be a lawyer back in the day because the LA Law was like the popular show.
How many lawyers are, is that show responsible for creating who should not be in that position?
That's right.
So you go from corporate VC, which is a very interesting start, especially in the fintech, insurtech space. But also, I would argue, and you know better than I do, I've never worked at a corporate VC, but I imagine maybe the rigidness is a bit more than actually joining your common, venture firm. You pivot from that to, I think it was Lightbank, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty closely after that. And that was arguably your first real kind of venture in the, seed and series A space in Chicago. You join as a managing partner and you're really leading the investment team there. You guys are responsible for some of the kind of most notable deals, I would say, in the ecosystem from companies like ClearCover, Snapsheets, Sprout Social. There's a bunch of these really, really cool companies. What was that 3.5 year period like at Lightbank? You know, especially as the Chicago ecosystem is catching fire, it's growing rapidly. Right. There's a lot of excitement, right, to be in that seat.
You know, it was, I left Chicago, it was like 2000, I think, was it 2004? Mm-hmm. I think, no, 2005. I have to go back to the year my son was born. Yeah. So that 2005 timeframe. It was super interesting to see the technology ecosystem I left then versus the one I came back to, right? The one I came back to that had things like MHUB and 1871 and several early stage venture capital funds here in town. Like none of that was here when I left. So it was great to kind of see that maturity of the community. It was great to see it come up. You know, we had more established angel groups then too. Like there was none of these angel networks or angel groups really going on back then either. So you know, to see that robustness there was really exciting. And then, like, you know, we had some great wins coming out of this town by then as well, which were, you know, kind of plant the flag type of things. So it was really exciting to come back and see just the healthiness and the growth that was in the technology and the venture community here in town.
Mm. Yeah, because I moved in late 2019. So what you're describing is really what I came into. But for someone who was here in the early 2000s, I mean, Chicago must have looked very different from the startup lens. I mean,
yeah, I mean, even so, I was doing startups here in Chicago in 19, well, as a lawyer, 98 through 2000, give or take. And then doing startups 2000 to till I left in 2004. And you have to understand, there was maybe three venture firms here in town. Like, maybe three, right? And one was doing life science, and one was kind of generalist, and one was like a glorified family office. Like, there was nothing, right? Nobody, like, at that point, the coastal firms were even more focused on themselves than they are now. Like, they would never think about getting on a plane back then and coming here, right? This was at the high times and everything was great. And then at the crash, everything went to hell. They definitely weren't leaving their foxholes there. And so, like, you would never see like a Bain coming to town and doing deals, or Excel or Sequoia or any of these other firms that are here now and have portfolio companies here now. So it's just completely night and day. Like, you know, all of like the tech corridor was about a block and a half on Kinzie Street. That was about it. Like, there was no West Loop. There was no Fulton Market. There was none of these like things here. You never in a million years would have thought you'd see Google with this many people here, those types of things. So it was great to come back and see all this.
What were some of the most notable patterns you recognize with your experience investing in some of the best names that Chicago had to offer, whether it was from, you know, what the companies were doing or what the founders were like? I'm sure you've seen, probably written down some patterns, right? Like, what are the Michael Jordans in your world look like? What do they have in common?
I think the ones that had the great ones, right? And the CEOs that you mentioned, like the companies. Yeah, like those great ones, like they all, whether it's Justin Howard or Kyle, like they all had this awesome, incredible balance of what I call like Midwest pragmatism, caring about their people, but yet we're thinking 20 light years ahead of everybody and blazing trail. Like, they knew how to be these visionary leaders, but yet everybody could relate to them and love being on their team, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, whether it's the Sprout team or the Clear Cover team or even the Snapchat team, like, people loved being part of those teams because of those leaders. They had this healthy sense of self-authenticity. They were great folks, but yet you could see them totally blazing trail and tearing things up, right? They weren't like the manic, egotistical, quintessential West Coast, you know, CEO type of folks. Like, they were just, they know they were going into huge industries. They knew they were going to have to work with and around large incumbents, but they knew they were going to conquer it all and make a difference. And it's kind of this weird dichotomy, if not just bipolar, that you can be like a good kind of Midwestern raised solid person and yet be able to kind of operate at that next level of a visionary. So that's what I see in kind of the great CEOs. And I see in the great CEOs we've backed here at Energy Capital Ventures, right? That's kind of the consistent theme I see on folks, and the ones that really kind of blazed a trail and like ended up being huge fund returners for the folks I've worked with.
What was that decision to, speaking of Energy Capital Ventures, which I want to get into, how do you go from software and tech, before that fintech, insurtech? Again, you've had so many interesting pivots in your career, to then recognizing that there's this massive imperative around ESG, green hydrogen. There's kind of a shift in how the industry is moving towards. When was that decision for you to say, you know what, I want to start a venture fund around this?
Yeah, so like, It's interesting because, like, if even myself, if you look at it on paper, like, this makes no freaking sense whatsoever. Right? Until I started to explain, like, what really drew me into fintech and insurtech. Now, granted, I was in that industry, so I had a different perspective on it. But when I did things like Coinbase and MX and Personal Capital and even TrueCar, Snapsheet, ClearCover. These, to me, InsurTech and FinTech were solving a fundamental societal problem that people were either underbanked, overbanked, or unbanked, right? You were either overinsured, underinsured, or uninsured, because the traditional incumbents only made money by selling a certain product, certain way to certain people. And that either overdid it for you or underdid it for you. And I knew the only way we were going to, and to me, financial security, it is the fabric of every community and families, right? If they don't have financial security, everything kind of falls apart from there. And so I knew the financial products of tomorrow need to be different than they were today if society was going to get ahead. And so that's what really got me into FinTech and InsurTech and really made me a champion around those things. So when I had done that for, I don't know, 10 plus years, I got to work with a lot of those great names and plus tons of other great names that I don't have time to mention. I was like, you know, I thought I was just going to go back to financial services again. I'm like, I know this stuff. I've lived and breathed it. Like, I'm super comfortable here. I like
what I'm the innovation side of it as well.
And, you know, I sat down with, when I was decided to move on, I sat down with a good buddy of mine, Rick Vitone, partner with me here at ECV. And I'm like, hey, Rick, you know, I'm thinking about doing something different. You know, we've done a bunch of deals together. Should we partner up on things? And he's like, we're 100% going to partner up. I've been waiting for you to come off the bench. This is awesome. Let's go. I'm like, oh, great. He's like, but we're not going to do it in FinTech. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, I need you to look at the energy space. I was like, Rick, never even came up. And not even on my radar. He's like, spend some time. Let me, because what I didn't know is Rick also has an investment banking background in the energy space. He's like, let me introduce you to see some of these energy companies, read some of these analyst reports and tell me what you think. And let's catch up next week when you're in New York. So do all the work, meet at the CEOs or a lot of companies that are LPs in my fund right now. And what I saw was at the macro level, an aging infrastructure, things they were battling, right? Aging infrastructures, regulatory burdens, people questioning their business model, new technologies they didn't know if they were going to enable or disrupt them, a super risk-averse conservative environment, customer satisfaction issues. And reality is that was financial services 20 years ago. Some would say that's financial services right now. So I was like, okay, get it. Like, the whole macro makes sense. I was, you know, just jokingly say it's kind of the same complaints all these other CEOs had in financial services. Their accents have just changed now where I'm here. And you know, and so started looking at that and then started looking at kind of the societal impacts that are there. And similar to financial services not being able to serve the communities of today, let alone tomorrow, if you look at energy security and energy equality, like clean, safe, reliable, cost-effective energy is fundamental to everything. It's even more fundamental than financial security, because if you don't have energy, you don't have anything, right? Mm-hmm. And there's the companies, especially those we work with in the natural gas industry, which are trying to understand the technologies of tomorrow. They're trying to understand how should their businesses adapt? What are the right technologies for them to bet on, bring into their businesses, and provide to their customers? And, you know, the natural gas industries do things fantastic. Like, there's some things they do fantastic, a lot of things, right? When it comes to serving their customers, doing it safely, reliably, and cost-effectively. Communicate with technology companies, understanding, you know, the next generation of RNG, hydrogen, and the rest, biofuels, digital transformation, methane emissions management, kind of not their strongest suit, right? Because they have different jobs to do in their day. So I was like, wait a second. If I can come here and have an impact on that and be part of the solution for the industry of tomorrow, that's even more exciting than when I first started in financial services. So, you know, I kind of just spent the time, like at the beginning of everything, studying, right? You know, talking to as many people as I could, reading everything I could, and I'm still doing that. And then came together with my partners here. And it's great because my partners, Rick Vitone, Jeff Yingling, Ray O'Connor, they're all 30 plus year investment bankers in the energy space.
So they know the space really well, right?
They know the space, they know the people, and these people have their trust in them. What they were looking for, they were looking for a partner that was experienced in venture capital.
Exactly.
That also understood how to talk to large corporations and understand large corporations. So it was kind of like, Rick's like, yeah, I've been on 3 or 4 boards with Vic. I've known the guy 10 years. Like, he's what we need. And guess what? He's not doing anything right now. So, So, after 18 months of fundraising through COVID, a bunch of civil unrest, we raised our first fund, and we are out now as the only early stage venture capital fund that's solely dedicated to the sustainability, resilience, and digital transformation of the natural gas industry.
That's phenomenal. And you were telling me that first fund was $61 million in aggregate. Yeah. It makes a ton of sense, by the way, especially the value that you bring. That's how I thought about it, because who you're raising from kind of mimics the corporate venture model. Right. I'm assuming these massive oil and gas companies, to your point, aren't as user-friendly with the technology side. And they probably don't want to deploy anything internally. Usually corporates are not as good at doing that as let's say, indirectly investing in a different startup. That sole focus is that, without having the politics and kind of the corporate hierarchy overhead. So I think that makes a ton of sense. What I wanted to ask you is, in those 18 months, what was the most difficult feedback that you received when you were trying to fundraise for this specific vertical?
Well, a lot of difficult feedback. So I think, you have to understand too, the time we did it, like we started fundraising, we were on our first roadshow in March of 2020, right? So like, we're literally on a plane and the COVID lockdowns start happening. Like, we're landing in Phoenix and people are like, you can't come to the building. I'm like, what do you mean we can't come to the building? They're like, we've locked everything down. And so, to start a fundraising at that standpoint, not optimal, right? But I think, it's no different than entrepreneurs that are out there fundraising that, I had to say no to or have to say no to is, we met with a lot of these companies and they're like, Vic, Ray, Jeff, Rick, like, you're exactly what we need. Like, we love what you're doing. Like, the industry needs this. But they're like, we're just not comfortable doing venture capital. Like, we're just not ready yet. So can we see how this works out and look at it at your next fund? And at this point, I don't have a job. We've been fundraising for a year. And I'm like,
I need to check now,
It's no different than like a seed stage entrepreneur that like, they're like, oh, come back at Series A. No, like if there's no seed, there's no Series A. So I think the difficult feedback was meeting these great folks, making connections with them, having them come to appreciate who we were as a team and what we wanted to accomplish and the unique model we had. And yet they still said no, right? They're like, yeah, your track record is great. We've already diligenced that. And like, you guys are the right people doing this for the right reason. We're just not ready. So, that was difficult because I think what we offered to them as a quote unquote product was kind of the best of both worlds, right? It's that traditional fund structure, GP and LP, where we as a management team have full and sole authority around investments, but we provide the strategic value back on our engagement to them as corporates as if they had their own corporate venture group. Now, the reality is some of them have their own corporate venture group, but those corporate venture groups realize they get to do things with us that they couldn't necessarily do on their own. And that one is better or worse. It's just different. And in this case, different adds to the pie, not take away from it. So, we have these things where we do these deep dives with them and round tables, and we have these receptions for them, and we do this very pointed one-on-one meetings with them as well and different technology spotlights that are important to them. So it was really things that the natural gas industry was looking for. And like I said, even those that had their own corporate venture group or their own innovation group, it was the complement to what they were doing that they really were looking for. But nonetheless, you'd get the notes. Or you'd get the no's that we're not yet. Like, we want to talk fund too. So.
What is your process? So when that happens, right? Like, you go into a meeting. This is a really important meeting. You guys think that this is in the bag and it's a W for you and the fund. Yet they're excited, but they're like, no, that doesn't work, Vic. Sorry about that, man. Let's meet in the next 3 years. What is your process when you leave that meeting room to stay mentally, level set?
Yeah. So it's kind of the two ways you leave the rooms because, some of them are like, oh, we're going to do something else. Okay, fine. Most of them, it was like the not bad breakups, but it was difficult. They're like, we're not going to do your thing. We're fine. It's not you, it's us. We're not ready. But can we do the strategic engagement with you along the way? Okay. Like, can we still stay in touch? Can we do some, you know, brainstorming sessions on hydrogen? Can we bounce ideas for you? And these are really good people that you want to work with. And, you know, eventually you are, odds are. And, but it's a, like, it's kind of a balance. I'm like, because some of them you have to say, well, yes, I'm doing that with the people that are actually giving us money as investors. So it's kind of disrespectful for them, for me to provide the same value to you that is not investing, right? Because the resources I'm deploying to you, I can't deploy to them. The really hard part was finding that balance with the not yets to say, okay, we're going to do our thing in green molecules. We are going to be the only firm that's advocating for innovation in green molecules, which puts us in a different space, literally. And so, you know, what's that right balance for people that said no, that, okay, let's just connect with them kind of intermittently. When we see things that are important to them, we're going to get it over to them. And how are we going to make this a win for everybody? And the reality is we did. We found a way to like have kind of a light interaction with the folks that aren't ready yet. And then the deep interaction and engagement with the folks that are actually RLPs. And to the point now, we did some math on it. There's over 30, maybe 32 different pilots or commercial relationships going on with companies we actually decided not to invest in. Like we said, no, we're not investing, right? Wrong. We didn't like the price, wrong stage. Didn't really think it was a venture deal, but we still took those companies and made connections to either RLPs or our broader network of corporates that we knew that was important to them. So we try to create as much benefit for the industry as possible with the hope that, you know, people will understand like, oh, these guys are the true advocates for green molecules. It's just not lip service. They're trying to help, even if maybe it's not in their direct interest or direct benefit.
Of course. Yeah. I love that. I mean, hopefully people unpack if you're not in venture, but the takeaway for anyone listening is always try to serve, I would say, figure out how you can serve and be of value when it's also not transactional and relevant to you in the moment. You know, even if there's no dollar attached to it, because sometimes it pays dividends. Most times, sure. I would argue. Vic, I want to get into just quickly on the I know you mentioned molecules. A lot of people listening probably aren't tied to the energy space. Sure. So in sort of more simple layman kind of business terms, what areas are you seeing that are most exciting right now that either companies are chasing or you as an investment firm in that space are looking at?
Yeah, our thesis in green molecules kind of has two pillars, if you will. One is sustainability and resilience. That gets us into all the hard tech and deep tech. And then the digital transformation, which is your traditional software for operational efficiency, safety, digital transformation, those types of things. You know, the really exciting things that I see that are going to really change the face of this planet when it comes to their energy, serving their energy needs in a clean, safe, reliable, cost-effective way, are definitely in that sustainability resilience standpoint. So there's a lot of exciting things happening in hydrogen, right? Hydrogen is a next generation fuel source, or I would say this generation fuel source. Just a matter of cracking the code on manufacturing cheap hydrogen, right? So it's actually cheaper than natural gas, but yet can flow through the natural gas system, right? So you're taking advantage of the assets that are in place. We'll have an announcement coming out in the next week on that. I'd love to tell you more about it, but hopefully press release goes out the next week, maybe two. It always takes longer, right? So we've done some investing there. We're super excited about that. We're also excited about the future of renewable natural gas as well. So taking waste to gas, waste to an energy source, whether that's agricultural waste, wastewater, and then throwing it through an anaerobic digestion process to create natural gas. And you know, these are these energy sources that are super dense, right? They create, like, they're super dense and efficient. Like, you're not losing huge amounts of energy when you go from production to transmission to distribution, right? You're cost effectively getting energy to people's places. And so what we like are those hard tech molecular types of things. There's lots of people doing things on the grid with electrons, and we think that's great, but we just feel like that's served enough, right? There's plenty of people chasing wind, solar, batteries, in those types of storages. We're looking for the other side of the energy equation around the molecules. And we think those next generation energy sources around the molecules are really going to be the ones that solve a lot of the world's problems. Because, you know, as a firm, we look at it this way. If you solve energy, you solve climate. If you try to solve climate without solving energy, you end up with, like, you know, debutantes flying around their private jets, burning more carbon than any of us will ever burn in our entire life. And, you know, spouting, you know, platitudes, right? So we really look at it from that green molecules energy standpoint.
When you were first getting started with this fund structure and thesis, did you find it difficult to balance the innovation piece with the sustainability when you're trying to make these investment choices?
My lawyer answer, yes and no, right? So first of all, when we started this thing, Green Molecule, when we started called Green Molecules, everyone laughed at us. They're like, that's stupid. Like, you should be on the grid. Like, no one's doing this stuff. Like, yeah, this is 2020, and we were talking about hydrogen, renewable natural gas, biofuels, emissions management. People are like, oh no, that stuff never going anywhere, right? Where we were seeing this enormous amount of innovation in the space in an industry that needed it. So people are like, no, that's not what you should be doing. That's not it. Now play the tape forward and now look at everything you're seeing, whether it's on the regulation front with the IRA or in Canada with the ERA, you know, hydrogen, renewable natural gas, emissions management, the natural gas system. Like, people are like, oh yeah, that's 80% of the world's energy. We need to make it better, right? So the focus has kind of shifted. So we're seeing even those pure play electrification firms come into, quote unquote, our space in green molecules. We're seeing the generalist firms that aren't even energy or climate related come into our space. And we think it's great. Come on in. The water's deep. We need folks here with us. We can't do it all. And so that was kind of it. And so to your particular question, people had a lot of questions like, how does hydrogen solve for the climate, right? Well, let's unpack it. Like, done right, if you use synthetic biology to create hydrogen, you're actually net, you're not even net zero, you're actual zero, right? It's a clean, cheap, I would say easy to transport energy source that will be the sources of tomorrow. People are like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, renewable natural gas, people are like, well, it's still gas. Yes, but it's actually kind of almost circular because you're taking waste product, whether it's food or agriculture farms or wastewater, and creating energy, right? Energy that's super dense, energy that's super efficient, that actually reduces the emissions and needs for other energy sources. So it's been, it took people a little while to do that. And then people are realizing that, you know, if you talk about all fossil fuels the same, it's like saying the average temperature in the United States. Well, that's meaningless, right? Depends where you're at, right? And so if you look at natural gas and the natural gas infrastructure as a way to transport and create these future sources of tomorrow, like, okay, that's part of the solution that's going to get us away from burning coal. That's going to tighten up the pipes within the oil and gas industry so that they have less fugitive emissions. We're going to reduce flaring. We're going to reduce venting. We're going to make something that is clean as a whole, even cleaner, right? So the point where, you know, wind and solar are, they have reliability issues. It's just because the sun's not always out and the wind's not always blowing and batteries are only going to store so much. So how do we work together with all these solutions to bring them together so communities of all socioeconomic standpoints, as well as all geographies, can benefit from energy? So then it's...
Are you realizing there's a bit of ESG fatigue at the moment? I saw this kind of headline recently. I can't remember. It was like an article, but I'm sure you crossed into this, you know, because you see, you see companies all the time, and maybe not, I'm not saying these are the ones you work with, but there are big corps that, you know, claim all these ESG metrics and all these, you know, goals and objectives, and how much of it actually gets done and the impact is always kind of questionable.
Yeah. You know, I think we realized early on, or I know we realized early on, it wasn't about ESG or ESG for ESG's sake. It was really about sustainability and resilience of energy. Like, if you could solve that, all this other stuff, when, no matter what acronym you put on it, goes away. Right. Mm-hmm. So focus on the value of the innovation and not the acronym, that if we bring clean, safe, reliable, cost-effective energy, leveraging the assets we have, the world wins. Right. And like I said, the environment for environmental sake, you know, where you've got, like I said, the platitudes and the virtue signaling and everything else, it was like, no. Right. And that's what got us into the situation we are. Right. Because a lot of the ESG promises were just hollow, shallow platitudes, right? And a lot of virtue signaling and not solving anything. So, and the reality is, these are new technologies. It's going to take time to get there, and we're going to get them there, and we're going to do the hard work.
Mm. I want to end on this last note, which is more on the leadership side. I follow you on LinkedIn, and I always give you props on the content that you post, which is actually a lot more on the leadership piece, on the entrepreneurial lens. It's not very like technical on the energy side, as an example, which I thoroughly enjoy. The leadership question I want to end with is more so about leading change. Mm-hmm. Because you've been a leader in your career across different roles, organizations. You've led people, you lead stakeholders still, you lead because you oversee a ton of capital. But I think more importantly now is you're actually leading a bit of a movement in a nascent, you know, emerging vertical. Sure. What are your biggest lessons learned when it comes to leading change?
Yeah, I think there's two big lessons I've learned when it comes to leading change. The first, if you want to have generational long-term impact and change, you've got to learn how to be effective working inside of a system, working inside of an industry. Because you could stand on the outside and throw rocks at an industry and criticize it and make fun of it, and people are going to turn you around and you're never going to make a change. However, if you can get inside of the industry, become an important part of it, and people come to understand and relate to what you're doing and respect it, that's when you can make great change. That's when you see mass adoption of new technologies. That's when you see like true game-changing impact. And so I think that is the first lesson on it. And the second lesson is once you're inside, people have to understand that you're doing it for a higher purpose. You're doing it for a bigger reason. It's bigger than you. It's bigger than your company. It's bigger than your firm, your technology, your family. It's something that you're going after because you truly want to do something that equates to a higher purpose and a bigger reason. And so between learning how to be effective inside an industry and having people understand and truly believing it, that you're doing this for a higher purpose, a bigger reason, that's what really creates change. And that's what gets people to adopt change, because inherently people don't want to change. They're pretty comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. And if it becomes that they're going to change because of some dire circumstance, that's never really good, right? Because that effect of change, people are like, even if you're in a big company, like, I don't need to change. Like, I got 10 years between me and retirement. I'm not going to screw it up. I just need to do it. But if people know that you're part of a system, you're part of an industry, you're an advocate, but you're really doing it for a higher reason, to create a better